We're very good as doctors in general at talking to each other, but the value of us telling stories is probably greater when we tell those stories to the general public.
Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann, and we cover the whole conversation on sleep. And today is our first ever on-location recording, and I'm speaking to Dr. Guy Leschziner. And he's a consultant neurologist, and he heads up the clinical team at one of the largest sleep disorders clinics in Europe, which also happens to be just down the road from us in London here. So we're going to be talking about sleep medicine and how that works here in the UK and contrast that with other places in the world. But also we're going to talk about Dr. Leschziner's brand new book, The Nocturnal Brain, which tells the stories of many of the patients and the case studies that are seen at the sleep disorders clinic here. So we had a great conversation, and I really think you'll enjoy this episode. That's it for the introduction. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and you can also check us out on social, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and also on the website sleepjunkies.com. Okay, on with the show.
Good morning. I'm sitting here today with Dr. Guy Leschziner, and he's very kindly invited me down to Nuffield House, which is the location of the Sleep Disorders Centre at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in London. Thanks very much, and good morning, Guy.
Good morning.
Let me give you a brief introduction. Now, Guy is a consultant neurologist at the Sleep Disorder Centre at Guy's in St. Thomas's. You're the clinical lead, is that right?
Yeah.
So you head up the clinical team here. He's also a reader in neurology at King's College, and you do clinics here in neurology and sleep disorders and epilepsy. You also lecture, and you've got lots and lots of research interests in various sleep disorders. If that's not enough, also in the last couple of years, Guy has also been heavily involved in some public education projects. One of them we're here to talk about specifically, which is a new book. It's a great book. It's called The Nocturnal Brain. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And also, you've recently done a three-part series on the BBC Radio 4 and a TV series, The Secrets of Sleep. Now, how do you manage to fit all that in?
The answer to that is with great difficulty. I think it's always a bit of a juggling act, and certainly it's a case of prioritising certain projects at any one time. So I think probably everything suffers, including personal life, but it's just a case of trying to achieve that right balance.
So it's probably an impossible question. What's a typical day for the clinical lead at Guy's?
The typical day is much like any other consultant, really. I obviously do clinics, and I do ward rounds on the neurology side, some management issues, particularly in terms of dealing with a very big service like the sleep disorder service here. We've got, I think at last count, 15 or 16 doctors, of which the vast majority are consultants, that work within the sleep disorder centre. So you can imagine that when you're running a clinical service, trying to get commercial and research trials going, and all the management that comes with being within a large bureaucratic organisation like the NHS, that keeps you pretty busy.
So I wasn't aware. I'm actually just down the road from here. I'm like two stops on the metro. But this is one of the largest sleep units in Europe, I believe.
Yeah, I think that it's very difficult to get figures. But certainly in terms of the number of doctors that we have working here and the number of patients that we see every year and the number of sleep studies that we do every year, we're certainly one of the largest centres. And when I talk to colleagues from around Europe, I think that's very much their view as well. In terms of comparing numbers, what I think marks us out as a sleep centre is that we are one of the very few sleep services that, first of all, has what we term a lifespan sleep service. So we work very closely with our paediatric colleagues who are based at the Evelina Children's Hospital.
Yep.
And in fact, we run joint clinics together to enable people to transition between paediatric and adult services. but we also are a proper multidisciplinary service in that the consulting staff that we have here come from a variety of backgrounds. So neurology, respiratory medicine, psychiatry, neuropsychiatry. We have in-house psychologists as well. So we really do run a multidisciplinary service. In fact, I think that it's actually very, very difficult to provide a proper sleep service without having that kind of multidisciplinary service. We meet on a weekly basis and discuss our difficult patients because it sounds really obvious, but sleep is as a result of the confluence of a variety of factors, biological, and those biological factors can be neurological or respiratory or cardiac, psychological, environmental and behavioural. And it's difficult to address some of the sleep disorders that we see looking at it just from one particular angle.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I'm really interested in this concept of sleep medicine. If you look at the States, you have big bodies. You've got the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Now, we don't have anything like that in the UK. So what are your views on the way that we approach sleep medicine as a whole in, let's just stick to this country?
Yes, I think you've highlighted an important issue, which is that there is no formal training program for sleep medicine in the UK. So historically, sleep medicine in the UK has primarily been driven from little silos, primarily respiratory medicine. So for many years, sleep medicine was largely seen as sleep apnea and insomnia, and the psychiatrists took on insomnia and the respiratory physicians took on sleep apnea. Occasionally, a neurologist would come in when there was a question mark as to whether or not something that was happening in the night was epilepsy or not. But it was all done in a very disjointed way. I think to some extent that's still very much the case. And certainly speaking from my own experience, much of what I've learned about sleep medicine has come from working alongside, not in different buildings or different centres, but really side by side with my respiratory, psychiatric, neuropsychiatric and psychological colleagues. And without having that exchange of ideas, that exchange of experiences and expertise, I think it's very difficult to practice sleep medicine in its fullest sense. There have been some noises made, particularly by some of my colleagues and also through the British Sleep Society, to try and develop a proper core curriculum for people who want to pursue a career in sleep medicine. But it's very difficult to make that headway because it does sit in an area of medicine that is not very clearly defined.
Yeah, I know there's some people in Oxford putting courses through to, you know, train people on a sort of postgraduate level.
Yes, so there's a master's in sleep medicine in Oxford, but I think that's not primarily focused at clinicians, at doctors. It's a more broader course. But in terms of medical training, you know, in the same way as, you know, when we do neurology, we have to do our general internal medicine. Once we've fulfilled our 5 or 6 years of curriculum and expertise, then we are given something called a certificate of completion of training, which says you are now a consultant neurologist. We don't have anything similar in sleep medicine.
Yeah, so there's no such thing as, you know, board certified in sleep medicine or anything like that?
No, there is a European exam now, which some of our juniors are doing, which at least gives them some sort of qualification in sleep medicine. But it's not the same as calling yourself a consultant neurologist or a consultant respiratory physician.
Yeah. What are your candid views on that? Is that helpful or does that give more flexibility in the sense that you're not working in such strict parameters?
Well, I think there are pros and cons. I have to say, I think the cons outweigh the pros. So the pros are that people come from lots of disparate environments and can develop an interest in sleep regardless of their past experience. But that's also a con. It means that, you know, there are a lot of people who have a very limited view of sleep medicine and only see it from one particular perspective. And that sometimes, I think, is at great detriment to the patient sitting in clinic hoping to get a fully formed opinion about their sleep issues.
Yeah, so it could depend on their particular ailment, which specialist they're talking to, how far deep down the rabbit hole that person's actually gone into sleep.
And I think it can also result in people with sleep issues seeing a variety of different clinicians and being passed around, which is sometimes deeply frustrating for the patient, But it's also frustrating for the clinician as well. It delays people getting to the right diagnosis. It delays treatment.
So average GP, and I certainly have looked into this a little bit in the States, they'll get 2, 3, 4 hours maximum of specialist training in sleep.
Yes.
Not sure what the situation here is in the UK.
Probably worse, actually.
Right, right. So that's not optimal, really, is it? So how would you see that progressing? How would that start to happen?
Well, I think that there have been some changes recently. A lot of medical schools are now at least putting sleep on the curriculum at medical school. And I guess that one of the purposes of what I've been doing over the last few years is to try and spread the word of sleep medicine, to make people aware. You know, we're very good as doctors in general at talking to each other and lecturing at each other and telling our stories to each other. But one of the things that I unfortunately realized quite late was that actually the value of us telling stories is probably greater when we tell those stories to the general public, because the general public are the people who are experiencing these disorders, and spreading the knowledge that these disorders, first of all, exist, and secondly, that there are treatments available for these disorders, is actually perhaps one of the most valuable ways that we can communicate more broadly, to bring people to recognize the fact that they've got a condition, to recognize the fact that they can potentially get treatment for that. And actually, when we talk to the general public, there are plenty of doctors reading these books or listening to these radio programs or watching these TV programs. You know, books like Matthew Walker's book have really done amazing things for bringing sleep to the forefront. His book is very much about sleep and sleep deprivation rather than the sleep disorders that we would typically see in our clinics.
Yeah. Watching the Channel 4 series, especially, it's such an accessible medium for people, and you see real people, and most of these people have no idea of what's going on with their sleep. And it's something that I've picked up on over the years, that there is just this massive, massive education gap. So I think, as you say, giving the public the opportunity to find out these things first, and then maybe next time they go to the doctor, they'll say, oh, I saw this program on TV last night, and he said that this kind of condition exists. So maybe there's this sort of a bottom-up kind of kind of thing that could work.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in the book, I describe a case of somebody who was diagnosed with quite severe sleep apnea. And actually, the diagnosis eventually came from her, because she had been going to her GP for years and years, saying, I feel dreadful, I feel tired, I don't know what's going on. And then actually she came across a video which was summarizing sleep apnea while she was waiting in her doctor's waiting room. And she went into her GP and said, I think I've got sleep apnea. And that was how she was diagnosed.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a case of patients being armed with the knowledge to educate their doctors.
Yeah. GP, there's a lot of American listeners out there, general practitioner, so that's your doctor who's your first point of call here in the UK. And then if you've got a specific ailment, you'll get referred to a specialist. If the GPs aren't being trained in sleep, then having programs and books and radio programs like this is better than Dr. Google, at least.
I think one of the other things to say is that although there's little in the way of formal education of sleep medicine, there are some issues which I think, at least in the UK, have really come to the fore in primary practice, in general practice. For example, this move away from sleeping tablets, long-term tablets. So I think that those kinds of changes in prescribing behavior, I think, do drive people at least to explore those kinds of conditions that they're seeing, and to educate themselves about, you know, the probably hundreds of patients that every general practitioner sees with insomnia every year. So there are some changes afoot that perhaps are outside that formal educational setting.
Yeah. Try and get back to some of my original questions.
Sorry,
it's always...
We're deviating.
No, I love it. This always happens. Okay, so just going back to your background, and I wondered if you could just sort of pricey your journey into sleep, and also maybe for the listeners, just explain what a neurologist does. And the reason I'm asking is because this idea of sleep medicine, In America, again, it's that you go see a sleep doctor, but that doesn't happen here. You see a specialist, as you'll say. And you trained in neurology, and also you did your PhD in epilepsy and the genetics of epilepsy, which some people may not associate with sleep at all. So I'm just wondering if you could explain that route and how you've got to where you are, where you're actually heading up a very big team of specialists in sleep medicine.
So I always knew that I wanted to do neurology as a specialty. I was always fascinated by the brain and how it really is the organ that defines every aspect of our being, every aspect of our consciousness. But when I entered into specialist training, as part of that, we had to do research, and I ended up doing a PhD, as you say, in epilepsy, prior to then going back into higher training. So during that higher training, it's about developing the experience and the expertise to diagnose and treat a range of neurological disorders as varied as carpal tunnel syndrome to epilepsy to dementia to Parkinson's disease, a whole range of things. So really dealing with every aspect of the nervous system, and that ranges from right from the cerebral cortex, the outer lining of the brain, all the way down to the muscles. The muscles are viewed as part of the nervous system. But during that PhD, where I was very much focused on epilepsy, I developed a subspecialty expertise in dealing with epilepsy, the diagnosis and the treatment of epilepsy. But actually, there are some parallels, significant parallels, actually, between epilepsy and sleep medicine. For a start, using the EEG, the brain waves, to classify sleep stages, to study sleep, but also to as a diagnostic tool for epilepsy. The range of drugs that are used, there is a significant overlap. But also, historically, one of the key areas for the neurologist in the area of sleep medicine was to differentiate strange things that happen in the night from epilepsy. And so that's where the role of the neurologist and the epileptologist in particular developed in terms of sleep medicine. I was always, to some extent, fascinated by sleep, and I remember that as part of my undergraduate degree, I did a module on what was termed at the time physiological psychology. And I remember being asked to go away and write an essay on the function of dreaming.
Right.
And came across the Crick paper from the 80s about the function of REM sleep, and being totally fascinated. But actually, when I was going through training and seeing a lot of epilepsy patients, it became very clear that as well as there being epilepsy in the differential for a range of sleep conditions, sleep in itself was a very important influencer of control of epilepsy, and indeed the management of a whole range of other neurological disorders, like migraine, for example. And it was really at the end of my training that I decided to take some time out of my training, and I essentially created a fellowship for myself, spending time at the National Hospital for Neurology, but also here at Guy's and St Thomas's, that really as I was nearing the point at which I was going to be a consultant, and in order to increase my experience and expertise in sleep. That's really how it came about.
Okay. So during this time, so, you know, lots of training, lots of specialization. And you say in your book that today, 2019, people are thinking differently about sleep. So obviously there's been a lot of advocacy and a lot of awareness. You know, mentioned Matthew Walker's book. But what are your overall views about why that's changed, and, you know, contrast today and maybe at the start of your inklings of getting into this area?
I think our knowledge base has increased exponentially. We have a huge amount of research being undertaken all around the world, both in terms of normal sleep and the functions of normal sleep, but also in terms of sleep disorders. So we are much more aware now of the long-term implications of poor sleep or of sleep disorders in terms of our physical health, and neurological health sits within that, but also in terms of our psychological health as well. So some of it has been driven by the primary research, and perhaps secondary to that primary research is the communication that is being done, the public engagement that is being done, that really helps people to understand the importance of sleep to their everyday lives.
Yeah, it's a tricky balancing act, you know, from my perspective, because for so long it's been something that's, you know, sleep when I'm dead, that kind of attitude.
Yes.
And now we're kind of slightly bombarded by this. So I think there's a balancing act between the instinctive common sense idea of sleep and then all the cutting edge research that we're finding out as well.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, really. I think this my slight anxiety about the media attention on sleep is that we have lost a common sense view of sleep. I think people are now, you know, so obsessed with measuring sleep, with, you know, even to some extent there's a degree of moralization about sleep as well, that actually this can, in some individuals, create problems rather than solve them. Because one of the very common things that I see are people who have historically had poor sleep. And, you know, we know that that often runs in families, it's often genetically predetermined, but then they read a range of articles or books that tell them that they're going to die younger, that sleep makes you look better, it makes you more intelligent, it makes you more creative, and it stops you from getting Alzheimer's and a whole range of other conditions. And so their anxieties about sleep increase exponentially, and then they end up with very, very severe insomnia. So it's trying to get that balance right about making sure that people are aware, making sure that people value sleep, but not seeing sleep as the be all and end all.
Yeah.
Because it is, it's a one aspect of our lives. It's a very important aspect of our lives, but it is one aspect of our lives. It's not the be all and end all.
I think there's a big room for that kind of angle. Yeah, we know a hell of a lot about sleep, but it's not all doom and gloom. There's
a lot. Well, we know a hell of a lot about sleep. We also don't know a hell of a lot about sleep. So if you look at some of the studies that have been done, the very large scale studies, you know, we're involved in a study at the moment that is using the UK Biobank, which is this huge collection of individuals, and looking at sleep in the UK Biobank cohort. But actually, if you look at the information that there is about sleep in those individuals, it's very, very limited. So we are drawing conclusions based on limited data. And I think that until we've got to the point where we can measure sleep properly in huge numbers of people for very, very long periods of time, some of those questions are going to remain unanswered. And so, you know, what I'm very keen about, and I do stress this in the book, is that actually that some of the tools that people are using to metricize sleep are not overly relied upon and actually don't achieve the increase of anxiety about sleep, because I think that that's a very real phenomenon. People need to relax a little bit about sleep as well.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it? We want the information, but at the same time, we need to not stress out about the bad things that we hear. So let's talk about the book and also the radio and the TV. I mean, this has all happened in the last couple of years, I believe, so it's quite new. But it's had a lot of comparisons. That people have compared it a lot to Oliver Sacks's work, the late Oliver Sacks, who told a lot of stories, case studies, but wrote very beautifully and about the strange ailments of his patients. I can really see the comparisons. So the book's called The Nocturnal Brain, subtitled Nightmares, Neuroscience, and the Secret World of Sleep. And it's structured a really nice, sort of easy to digest format, in the sense that each chapter deals with a specific subset of sleep disorders, but it's based on your personal case studies. These are all cases that you've dealt with. And then you'll slot a bit of science in there and a little analogy in there. So how did that come about? You're a busy guy. You've got a lot going on in your career. So,
well, if the truth be told, it was a bit of an accident, really.
I mean,
if you'd have said to me 3 years ago that I would be doing all of this, I would have laughed. I think that the radio series really was the thing that came first, despite the fact that the TV was broadcast earlier. And that really came about from a couple of chance meetings, really, with somebody from the BBC who I'd met at some social event. And we'd got chatting, and he said, oh, you know, you should come and discuss this. And at the time, I thought, actually, you know what? I'm far too busy. I can't do this. I don't want to do it. And I ignored it. And then 2 years later, I was in a slightly different situation whereby, you know, I think I alluded to some of the frustrations with managing a large service.
Well, and in the NHS, surely not.
you sound like you know about it. And I think I just thought, actually, you know what, I do need perhaps something outside the NHS to distract myself. And so I re-explored it. and went through a commissioning process. And there were a series of levels of whittling down those. And I ended up having to go and talk about the idea to a room full of commissioners. And eventually that got commissioned. And it was really purely by chance that at roughly the same time, I got a phone call from a TV production company who said, look, you know, we want to do something slightly different in sleep. And I think they chatted to one of my colleagues who works down in Exeter, who had given them my name. And at the time, I think I was just in that mental place where I just thought, well, why not? Sod it. And that's how those came about. The book, you know, as I said to you, I think before the interview started, I never had any intention of writing a book. I was always the person, when chatting to my friends and everybody would say, oh, I've got a book inside of me, I was the person that said, actually, I'm pretty sure I don't have a book inside of me. But actually, off the back of the radio series, I got approached by a literary agent who said, well, have you thought about writing a book? And once again, my first instinct was to say no. But he said, well, look, Christmas is coming. Why don't you try and write a chapter and see whether or not you like it? And then when I sat down, I actually realised I really enjoyed the process of, right. Of writing to a slightly different audience.
Yeah.
You know, as I was writing it, my English teacher's voice was ringing in my ears. And I thought, God, this is never going to happen. But actually, once I sat down, it came very, very quickly.
Right. So you weren't sort of sitting there for 5:30 in the morning, you know, saying, no. come to me, inspiration.
No, it was literally, you know, I would go off for a couple of hours, you know, when the kids were at, you know, whatever sports club they were at on a Saturday morning or in the evenings, and, you know, 2 or 3 hours here and there. So it was a surprisingly painless process.
I think the storytelling aspect is a really good one. We were chatting earlier about this idea of just getting knowledge out into the public sphere and maybe filtering upwards to, you know, the medical community. So the clinic here, you don't deal with primary insomnia. And I'm relating this to the book because the book talks about types of sleep orders that are rooted in neurological and breathing problems, things that come from the body or psychiatric places rather than primary insomnia. I just wonder if you could make that kind of distinction, because some people think, you know, I've got a sleep problem, I need to go to the sleep disorders clinic.
Yeah.
And then, but you might turn some of these people away and refer them elsewhere.
The reason why we don't see primary insomnia, and so what we mean by primary insomnia is insomnia without any other obvious underlying cause, is purely a question of capacity. As you know, insomnia is a very, very common sleep disorder. It's probably the commonest affecting, so chronic insomnia affects about 1 in 10 adults. We here don't have the capacity to deal with those very, very large numbers of patients. And because we are really quite specialised, it would essentially break our service. So we work very closely with a specific insomnia clinic that is based at UCLH, which is just north of the river. But they are set up to deal with pure insomnia on a much larger scale. But what we have done here is we recognise the fact that there are many people who don't necessarily present with a classic picture of insomnia, but have insomnia or a psychological root for their sleep disorder as the basis of their issues. So we have set up a service to deal with the psychological side of their sleep disorders. And we now employ a psychologist and an assistant psychologist, and we have other people delivering psychological treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, because a huge number of our patients have more than one issue. But to try and deal with their issues across two hospital sites just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense from in terms of the quality of care that we deliver. And from a patient experience point of view, it's terrible. So that's why we've divided up our services like that.
Yeah. Sorry, went off track a bit there, but I wanted to relate that to the book. So the type of people you'll see and the type of people you write about in the book, you know, some common conditions like sleep apnea, but also a lot of, let's say, you know, exotic conditions in terms of sleep disorders, parasomnias and circadian rhythm disorders, unusual behaviours during sleep. As I said, there's a lot to delve into here, but maybe if we can pick one specific example that I found really, really interesting, and it was your specialisation early in your academic career. You talk about a patient, Janice, in the book, who presented to the department here with a condition that was affecting her sleep. And it was a bit of a mystery at the start, wasn't it? And and it ended up turning out to be a form of epilepsy. And I, you know, I was really surprised because not that I'm a a doctor or a scientist or a medical guy at all, but you described epileptic seizures as large areas of synchronous electrical activity spreading through the whole brain. And then you go on to say that, well, sometimes that electrical activity is localized, and then sometimes things that happen in sleep stages can trigger that electrical activity, which can sometimes manifest into a form of epilepsy. And that must be quite interesting to try and work out and figure out what that is. I wonder if you could just talk about the case of Janice in that instance.
Yeah, so Janice presented with recurrent choking attacks at night and was screened on multiple occasions for obstructive sleep apnea, which is obviously the commonest cause of that. And those investigations always came to nothing. She came from quite a troubled childhood, which I detail in the chapter. And unfortunately for her, her nocturnal choking attacks were put down to psychological disturbance, and she was treated with a range of psychiatric medications.
Sorry to interrupt. Could you just explain that a bit more? Because it's pretty horrific, isn't it, what was happening to her at night?
Yeah, so she would be woken up sometimes as many times as 50 times a night with a sensation of choking or gasping that led her actually to become very fearful about sleep, to such an extent that she was trying to sleep deprive herself to prevent her going to sleep and experiencing these really rather unpleasant sensations. So she would wake up feeling like she was being strangled or suffocated. To cut a very long story short, essentially what was found to be the problem was that she had epileptic seizures arising in a very deep part of her brain called the insula, which is really the area of the brain that's responsible for sensation in the throat. Now, the association between epilepsy and sleep has been known about for centuries, in that we know that sleep deprivation is a potent trigger for seizures, and that certain seizures have a predilection for arising at night. There is something about the change in brain state in sleep that seems to facilitate the generation of certain types of seizures, predominantly seizures arising from the area of the front of the brain, frontal lobe epilepsy, which for many years was not really recognized as epilepsy in some cases, because one of the issues with seizures arising from that part of the brain is they often arise very deep. And the EEG, the brainwave test that we have, really only records electrical activity at the surface of the brain. So you may see apparently normal activity during these events. And it took, it was only in the turn of last century that we really understood that many of the things that we were seeing were actually epileptic in origin rather than non-epileptic. So in her case, because this area of the brain is very deep as well, it wasn't being picked up very easily on brainwave tests, but actually we used some other techniques to demonstrate the fact that these events were actually seizures that were resulting in that sensation of being choked. Treatment of her epilepsy resulted in a dramatic improvement in the quality of her sleep.
And this was something that was happening from early childhood.
It was happening from when she was initially taken into care because of family circumstances, which I think is in part what drove people to think that these had an underlying psychiatric or psychological origin rather than an organic, a biological cause.
This is one of the takeaways I got from the book and also from the TV series, just people completely unaware of the types of conditions they were having in their sleep. I guess all of these things, these education projects and the book and the TV and the radio, it's really valuable, I think, about just putting the message and putting the information out there. You also talk about narcolepsy in the book, sleepwalking, sleep motorbike riding. So loads of interesting stuff in there. There's a really interesting analogy, you touched on it just briefly there, about this idea of brain activity. And the EEG, which is the gold standard for measuring sleep. And you do an analogy, let's say you're asked to map the floor of the ocean, but you're only given a snorkel and a mask. I love that analogy because you're basically saying the EEG in terms of looking into the brain is, you know, it's like being given a snorkel. And there was a paper that came out recently. We're normally used to these few stages of light sleep and deep sleep and REM sleep, but they put some patients in an fMRI scanner and they clocked 19 different brain states.
Yeah.
And so the tools that you've got at your disposal, really, it must be quite frustrating when maybe you see someone presenting with some symptoms and you think, could be this, but I need more tools, more weapons.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the paper that you're referring to actually came out quite a while after I wrote the book.
Right.
But I think it is very supportive of the view that essentially our way of looking at sleep is based upon very incomplete information. So the staging of sleep, or the classical staging of sleep, is based upon very limited data. So with the new tools that are becoming available, we can really try and delve a little bit more deeply into sleep. And I think that one of the things that I hope has got across from the book is the fact that actually, even though there are these four classical stages of sleep, what we know, even using the EEG, is that different parts of the brain can be in different stages of sleep. So there are these transitions between even the classical stages of sleep that explain a lot of the phenomena that we experience both in normal sleep, but also in people with sleep disorders, things like sleepwalking, like lucid dreaming, like sleep-related hallucinations or sleep paralysis. And I think that, you know, what we really should be viewing sleep as is a spectrum of different sleep states rather than pure stages. Even scoring a sleep study using the standard methodology, you often see patients in whom you know you're not quite sure whether or not they're in stage one or stage two or you know.
Yeah.
And so there are these blurred boundaries everywhere. Now the study that you refer to using functional MRI and EEG looked at connectivity states, but I imagine that these 19 stages of sleep that they identified, even then, if you were to look at a bit more detail, you would probably see gradations within those.
Yeah.
So you know, sleep is a dynamic process. Mm. It's not a static process. Mm. And it's not a global process. It's a local process. So really, our view of sleep as being this binary state of being on or off, it has clearly died. But I think that what will eventually probably die is the view that there are these very clearly demarcated sleep stages.
Yeah, we look at the hypnogram and it's a square. It's a square graph.
I think we're probably going to be looking at curves in the future.
Yeah, and this idea of hybrid states, you know, lucid dreaming you mentioned. We're asleep, but we're conscious. I just wonder, just to round up, if you could just maybe give you touched on it there, but maybe make a couple of predictions about the future of sleep medicine. Let's pick a number, maybe 30 years in the future.
Wow, okay.
Put you on the spot.
It's always a difficult one. I think that our knowledge of normal sleep and the implications of normal sleep will have moved on significantly. I think that once we have tools to be able to track sleep long-term in large cohorts of individuals, and when I mean track sleep, I actually mean sleep rather than the sleep trackers that we currently use, which largely just track movement and heart rate and other physiological parameters, then I think that will enable us to unravel some of the complexities and the associations that we see between sleep and disrupted sleep and physical and psychological associations. So I think that will be a huge leap forward. I think that, you know, the use of big data alongside that, I think, will help significantly. In terms of the practice of sleep medicine, some of these tools that are available at the moment on a research basis will hopefully start percolating through to the coalface. But that's going to be a significant period of time, because at the moment these techniques are hugely cumbersome and hugely expensive. So, you know, fMRI, EEG, We've tried to do that a couple of times on a research basis. It's very, very difficult. Now, it may be that technologies come along that make that much more much more straightforward. I would hope that's the case, but it's impossible to predict.
Yeah. Well, that's what keeps us interested in the,
it certainly does,
in the field. Well, it's been really super interesting. I wish I could sit here and talk to you longer, but you've got things to do with and patients to see and all that. But thanks very much, Guy. I really, really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe. Check us out on social, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and on the website sleepjunkies.com. Hope to see you on the next one. Sleep well.